Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we are plunging straight into a landmark legal decision, Luxottica v. Airport Mini Mall. For you law students listening, this case is, well, it's a bit of a game changer. It fundamentally altered how landlords can be held responsible when their tenants are selling counterfeit goods, specifically trademark infringement.
Yeah, a really crucial area of IP law.
Get ready to understand how a $1.9 million verdict redefined looking the other way in intellectual property law.
That's right. This case really forces us to confront a crucial question with significant implications. Can a landlord be on the hook when vendors operating on their property are dealing in knockoffs?
Right.
Here we're talking about Luxottica, you know, the powerhouse behind iconic brands like Ray-Ban and Oakley, taking action against Airport Mini Mall and several individuals because their property was just, well, flooded with counterfeit sunglasses.
And a result, a jaw-dropping $1.9 million verdict against the landlords, which was upheld on appeal. That's not pocket change.
Definitely not.
The immediate question that leaps to mind, and I'm sure to yours as well, is how? How did the court arrive at such a significant decision? Let's unpack this.
Okay, let's set the scene. We're talking about the old National Discount Mall down in Georgia. Imagine walking in there and finding sunglasses, you know, plastered with Ray-Ban and Oakley logos being hawked for maybe 15, 20 bucks.
15 bucks? Seriously?
Yeah. Now consider that authentic Ray-Bans or Oakleys typically retail for, what, $140 to maybe $220? That staggering price difference alone should have screamed red flag from the rooftops.
Absolutely, like a flashing billboard of illegitimacy. And this wasn't some isolated booth, right? The mall housed around 130 different vendor booths.
Yeah, quite a few.
Each operating independently under a lease from Airport Mini Mall. So you have this central landlord overseeing a whole ecosystem of small businesses. It naturally begs the question, what level of oversight and responsibility do they bear for what's happening within those walls?
Precisely. And this leads us directly to the legal heart of the matter.
Yeah.
Contributory trademark infringement. The key legal standard here is the Inwood test. This test basically establishes when someone who isn't directly infringing the trademark can still be held liable.
Right. Not the one actually selling the fakes.
Exactly. There are two key ways this can happen under Inwood. First, if they intentionally induce the infringement. Or second, and this is the crucial prong in the Luxottica case, if they supply services or facilities to the direct infringer knowing that the infringement is taking place.
Okay, so we're zeroing in on that second part, providing services with knowledge of the infringement. And the core of the debate seems to revolve around this concept of knowledge. What exactly does the law consider knowledge in a situation like this? Is it just seeing it happen?
Well, the court really delved into this nuance. It wasn't simply a matter of whether the landlords had, you know, firsthand direct proof of every single counterfeit sale. The concept of constructive knowledge became absolutely pivotal here.
Constructive knowledge.
Think of it this way. Constructive knowledge means that the landlords had sufficient information to know, or really should have known, about the infringement, even if they didn't have direct, irrefutable evidence staring them in the face at every single moment.
Should have known. That sounds like it could be a bit subjective, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So what specific pieces of information led the court to conclude that the Airport Mini Mall landlords had this reason to know? What were the big signals?
This is where the timeline of events and perhaps more importantly, the landlord's response or really lack thereof becomes incredibly telling. Between 2009 and 2011, this mall wasn't just like suspected of selling fakes. It was the target of not one, not two, but three separate law enforcement raids.
Three raids. Wow.
Yeah. And these weren't just casual visits. They resulted in arrests and the actual confiscation of counterfeit merchandise, including these fake Ray-Bans and Oakleys. That's pretty undeniable proof of illegal activity happening right there on their property, wouldn't you agree?
Undeniable. You'd think that would set off every alarm bell imaginable immediately.
It certainly should have. But the warnings didn't even stop there. Luxottica themselves sent multiple formal cease and desist letters directly to the landlords.
Oh, so Luxottica reached out directly.
Yes. And these weren't vague complaints either. They specifically identified the sale of unauthorized eyewear and even pointed out specific booths within the mall where these fakes were being sold. So the landlords were being directly informed, in no uncertain terms, by the actual trademark owner about the ongoing problem.
That's about as direct a notification as you can possibly get. It really makes it hard to argue ignorance at that point, doesn't it?
It really does. And it gets even more significant when you consider this crucial detail. The lease agreements that the landlords had with their vendors actually included clauses allowing the landlords to terminate those leases if counterfeit goods were being sold.
So they had the power to kick them out.
Exactly. So they not only had clear evidence of the infringement from the raids and direct warnings from Luxottica, but they also possessed the legal and contractual means to actually do something concrete about it.
Okay, so just to recap here, they had proof from multiple police raids, they received direct specific warnings from the brand owner, Luxottica, and crucially, their own leases gave them the power to stop it. What action did they actually take, or perhaps more accurately, not take?
Well, that's the absolute crux of the case.
Uh-huh.
Despite all these glaring, flashing red flags, the court found that the landlords allegedly failed to evict the infringing subtenants.
They didn't evict them?
Apparently not. In fact, the evidence suggested that they even renewed leases with some vendors who had literally been arrested during those raids for selling counterfeit goods.
Renewed leases after arrests for counterfeiting. That's bold.
It's certainly a key fact. This inaction, you know, in the face of overwhelming evidence and the clear ability to intervene, is really what led to the jury's verdict and the appellate court's subsequent affirmation.
Okay, let's circle back to this really crucial idea of constructive knowledge. How did the court use this mountain of evidence, the raids, the letters, those ridiculously low prices, to conclude that the landlords had reason to know, even if they didn't personally witness every single transaction of a fake pair of sunglasses?
The court essentially just pieced together all those elements you just listed. The repeated law enforcement raids, the very explicit cease and desist letters naming the counterfeit eyewear, and of course, those incredibly low prices that were just an obvious signal of illegitimacy.
Right.
The court reasoned that any reasonable landlord presented with this consistent pattern of information would have undoubtedly known that widespread trademark infringement was occurring on their property. That's the essence of constructive knowledge. You may not have seen it with your own eyes every single time, but you had enough credible information hitting you from different angles that you absolutely should have been aware of it.
And then there's this other concept you mentioned, willful blindness. How does that factor into the court's reasoning? Is it different from constructive knowledge?
It is, yeah. Willful blindness takes the idea of should have known a step further.
Mm.
The court suggested that the landlords might have deliberately, you know, avoided taking steps to investigate or confirm the counterfeiting precisely so they could later claim they lacked actual knowledge.
Ah, the plausible deniability defense.
Exactly. It's the legal equivalent of the old saying, burying your head in the sand. The court essentially said that you can't intentionally avoid discovering illegal activity happening right under your nose and then try to use that self-imposed ignorance as a shield against legal responsibility.
That makes perfect sense. It's like actively choosing not to look and then claiming, well, I didn't see it, so it didn't happen. Now, I remember reading about the Tiffany v. eBay case. That one often comes up. Why wasn't eBay held liable for counterfeit Tiffany listings on their massive online platform? On the surface, it seems like a somewhat similar situation involving third-party sellers, right?
That's a really insightful question. And you're right, it does seem similar at first glance. Understanding the distinction between Luxottica and Tiffany v. eBay is crucial, though. While both cases do involve third-party infringement, the fundamental nature of the businesses, and critically, the level of control they exert are vastly different.
How so?
Well, eBay is an online marketplace. They host literally billions of listings from countless sellers all over the world. It would be practically, if not physically, impossible for them to physically inspect every single item being offered for sale before it's listed.
Right. The scale is just immense.
Exactly. The court in the Tiffany case recognized this inherent limitation and the sheer scale of the online platform. They couldn't reasonably be expected to police every listing proactively in that way.
Okay, so it really comes down to a matter of scale and the ability or inability to physically access and verify the goods being sold?
Precisely. In the Luxottica case, we're dealing with a physical brick-and-mortar mall. The landlords had direct physical access to every single booth within their property. They had the ability to literally walk in, to observe the merchandise being sold, especially after receiving those specific warnings and witnessing the aftermath of the police raids.
They could just go look.
They could. This direct control over the physical space and the practical ability to inspect is the key differentiator that separates Luxottica from the Tiffany ruling. The court essentially said the landlords in Luxottica had both the means to know about the infringement and the power to take direct action to stop it in a way that an online platform like eBay, due to its nature and scale, simply does not.
That makes the distinction much clearer. Thanks. Now, the lawsuit wasn't just against Airport Mini Mall as a corporate entity, right? It was also against several individuals. Who were these individuals and why were they held personally liable alongside the company?
Yes, that's right. Alice Jameson and Donald Ye were all found personally liable, while another individual, Jenny Ye, was not. Looking at their specific roles within the operation helps to understand why the jury reached those conclusions.
Okay, what were their roles?
Jerome Ye was apparently involved in direct communication with the police concerning the raids, so his awareness of the counterfeiting was pretty undeniable based on the evidence presented.
Hard to argue ignorance there.
Right. Alice Jameson was involved in the day-to-day management of the mall, including things like overseeing the leases, which made her knowledge of the ongoing issues highly probable, according to the court.
So boots on the ground, essentially.
In a management sense, yes. And Donald Ye was the owner of the leasing company itself, AMM, placing him in a position of ultimate oversight and control over the property and its operations.
So their specific roles directly linked them to both the knowledge of the infringement and their subsequent failure to take adequate action. That was the argument.
That's exactly. The jury likely found sufficient evidence connecting their individual responsibilities and levels of authority to the continued trademark infringement happening on the property. Jenny Ye, on the other hand, was found not liable. This suggests that the jury simply did not find enough direct evidence of her personal involvement, her specific knowledge, or a failure on her part to act in a way that contributed to the infringement.
Okay.
And that highlights an important point. Individual liability in these types of corporate or business cases requires a demonstrable link between the person's specific role, their actual or constructive knowledge of the infringing activity, and their failure to take reasonable steps within their power to prevent it.
So, wrapping this up, what is the major takeaway from this case for landlords going forward, and frankly for us aspiring lawyers listening in who might one day advise clients who own or manage commercial properties?
Well, I think the most significant impact of Luxottica v. Airport Mini Mall is pretty clear. Landlords can no longer afford to just ignore latent trademark infringement occurring on their property, especially once they have been put on clear notice.
The head in the sand approach is out.
Definitely out. This case firmly establishes that constructive knowledge, having a strong reason to know, is sufficient to establish liability for contributory trademark infringement under the Lanham Act in these types of landlord-tenant situations. Landlords have a clear responsibility now to proactively monitor the activities of their tenants, particularly when there are obvious red flags like repeated law enforcement actions, direct warnings from trademark owners, or those suspiciously low prices we talked about.
And not just monitor, but act.
Yes. And furthermore, they must take swift and decisive action to stop the sale of counterfeit goods when they become aware of it, or reasonably should have become aware of it. They can't just sit on their hands if they have the power to act, like terminating a lease.
It definitely sounds like this ruling creates a much stronger legal and, frankly, financial incentive for landlords to actively police their properties and deal effectively with counterfeiters. So, to bring our deep dive to a close, what is the core message we should all take away from the Luxottica v. Airport Mini Mall case?
The central message, I think, is this. Landlords cannot bury their heads in the sand when there is credible evidence of trademark infringement being carried out by their tenants. It's just not a viable defense anymore. When they have a clear reason to know, whether that's through direct warnings, police activity, or obvious indicators like those crazy low prices, and they possess the power to stop it, like through lease provisions, but fail to take reasonable action, they can be held legally responsible for contributing to that infringement.
So the key elements were all present here.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
The repeated warnings from Luxottica, the undeniable evidence of counterfeiting coming from the police raids, and the landlord's contractual ability to terminate those leases, coupled with their apparent inaction. Those were the critical elements that led directly to that significant $1.9 million liability in this particular case.
Fascinating, and definitely a crucial case for anyone involved in property law or IP law to understand. It really underscores the responsibilities that come hand in hand with property ownership and management, especially commercial properties. Mm. On that note, here's a final thought for you, our listeners, to consider. Given this ruling and the court's emphasis on a landlord's duty to act when they have reason to know about infringement in a physical space, what are the potential broader implications, if any, for online marketplaces, or maybe other service providers that host third-party content or sales? Does this case perhaps suggest a future shift, or at least a continued pressure point, in how liability for third-party infringement might be viewed beyond the traditional realm of physical marketplaces? Something to really think about. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive.